Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sarah Kendzior, author and co-host of the Gaslit Nation Weekly podcast, who examines the Trump regime's open sabotage of the U.S. Postal Service in advance of the November election and the Democratic Party response. Kevin Alexander Gray, a South Carolina-based author and activist who assesses Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden's pick of Kamala Harris as his vice presidential running mate, and energy and environmental security strategist Joel Gordis, who explains why in the face of ever more destructive storms, government and utilities must make the electric grid more resilient. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Mass protests gripped Belarus a week after the disputed re-election of President Alexander Lukashenko, an authoritarian leader often called Europe's last dictator. Lukashenko, who has been president since 1994, declared he had won over 80% of the vote in the August 9th election. Lukashenko's government has long been charged with vote rigging and election fraud. Peaceful protests quickly erupted in Minsk and other opposition strongholds. Regime opponents claim they won 70% of the vote in precincts where ballots were properly observed and counted. Security services loyal to the regime cracked down. In one case, police fired live rounds at protesters and had beaten activists. Opposition candidate Svetlana Tikhanovskaya fled to neighboring Lithuania after being detained by security forces while trying to file an election complaint. According to witnesses, detained protesters were stripped naked, beaten, and threatened with rape. President Lukashenko blamed the protests on criminals and the unemployed. After days of peaceful protests by women dressed in white carrying flowers, the hardline regime was losing support. At least 50 riot police officers took off their uniforms and strikes spread to automotive and truck factories. The European Union is considering imposing sanctions on Belarus, and neighboring countries Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania have called for a new presidential election. Former right-wing Colombian President Alvaro Uribe was placed under house arrest by the National Supreme Court as a result of an investigation into the bribing of witnesses involved with right-wing paramilitary groups during decades of political violence. Uribe, Colombia's president from 2002 to 2010, waged a U.S.-backed war against leftist FARC rebels while attracting foreign investment and tourism. According to NPR, ties with right-wing death squads have long dogged Uribe, now a senator and a leading supporter of Colombia's current president, Iván Duque, who defended Uribe as a genuine patriot. After the pre-trial arrest order, Uribe's allies in Congress called for an overhaul of the judiciary. Human Rights Watch defended Uribe's house arrest as a test of the rule of law in Colombia. During Uribe's regime, soldiers killed thousands of innocent civilians, then claimed they were guerrilla fighters in order to win promotions and other benefits. Under Uribe, government intelligence agents spied on journalists and opposition activists. Naturalist John Muir, one of the founders of the U.S. conservation movement, made his mark preserving the Yosemite Valley, supporting the establishment of the National Park Service, and founding the Sierra Club in 1892. More than a century later, the Sierra Club is coming to grips with Muir's objectionable racial views toward Blacks and Native Americans and his strong association with leaders of the American Eugenics Society and its links with Nazism. Sierra Club Executive Director Michael Broom confessed the dark history of Muir and early conservationists in a July 22nd blog post titled Pulling Down Our Monuments. Broom's post came in the midst of Black Lives Matter mass protests and efforts by big national environmental groups to come to terms with being early beneficiaries of white privilege. Moreover, Broom admitted the Sierra Club in its early years was an elitist organization limited to affluent white members whose mission was to preserve wilderness areas with little concern about the impact on the lives and culture of Native Americans. The Sierra Club pledged to make a $5 million investment to recruit staff from communities of color and open up executive positions to Black, Indigenous, and other leaders of color, so they'll comprise the majority of the team making top-level organizational decisions. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Another shameful chapter in American presidential history is now being written by Donald Trump and his cronies. Over the past several weeks, Louis DeJoy, a Trump campaign megadonor recently named Postmaster General, ordered the Postal Service to stop paying carriers and clerks the overtime pay needed to ensure that mail is delivered on time. Then news emerged that DeJoy ordered the decommissioning of 10%, or more than 670 of the Postal Service's costly mail sorting machines across the country, as well as the removal or locking of an unknown number of mailboxes in many cities and towns. The Post Office, in financial distress due to the coronavirus pandemic, had asked for $25 billion in critical funding, which has thus far been blocked by the President and the Republican-controlled Senate. Mr. Trump confirmed charges that he was deliberately sabotaging the post office in order to sow chaos in the November election when he admitted in a Fox News interview that he wanted to deny funding to the Postal Service ahead of November so that the postal system won't be able to handle an influx of mail-in ballots, which he falsely claims will lead to large-scale fraud. Soon after House Speaker Nancy Pelosi called the House back into session from its August recess to reverse recent changes to post office operations and to hold a hearing with Postmaster General LaJoy, the USPS announced it will suspend its removal of mailboxes for 90 days until after the election. Your reporter spoke with Sarah Kendzior, author of the book Hiding in Plain Sight, The Invention of Donald Trump and the Erosion of America, and co-host of Gaslit Nation, a weekly podcast. Here she examines the Trump regime's open sabotage of the U.S. Postal Service to gain partisan advantage in the November election and assesses the Democratic Party's response to the president's clear attempt to subvert the U.S. Constitution.
And we've been under that threat from the moment he declared candidacy, and certainly from the moment he took office. I've been worried about the legitimacy of the 2020 election since 2016, because we saw a lot of the same tactics in play then that he's using now, including domestic voter suppression as a result of the partial repeal of the VRA, foreign interference with mostly Russia, but not limited to Russia, intervening in our election, hackable machines, and then, of course, the threat of Trump refusing to concede, which was always a threat the whole time. As you said, he tells us his plans. He says he's not going to leave office. He says that in addition to the next 4 years, there's going to be an extra 4 years. And that, by the way, is why he installed Ivanka and Jared into the White House in, you know, a clear violation of nepotism rules, so that they could create a kleptocratic dynasty and keep this consolidation of power and this money train, this money laundering through the executive branch going. And then coronavirus kind of threw a wrench in those plans, because we were switching from electronic voting, which is less secure, to voting by mail, and paper ballots are much more secure. So, of course, the next move is going to be attack the Postal Service. When he couldn't delegitimize voting by mail by calling it voter fraud, which is something that, you know, they've been doing all along, they went for the institution itself. They installed a Trump lackey, a mega donor, Louis DeJoy. He then did a Postal Service purge and fired 23 senior officials for no reasons. We've all seen the pictures of trucks loaded up with mailboxes. We've all been struggling to even get our mail. People have been struggling to get food, to get medication. The voting problem is part of a broader assault on the American public by denying them a pivotal service and a beloved institution, an institution that has a 91% positive approval rating. So you could see right there, this is not a person who is trying to win an election. This is a person who is trying to steal an election. Someone who wants to win would not attempt to alienate and sicken and sabotage the public in the way that he's doing now and in the way that he's done for the last 4 years.
Sarah, one thing that's very concerning is, in the estimation of many, the Democrats' weak response to this direct attack on subverting the Constitution and the November election. We had the Democrats inviting the Postmaster General, the Trump mega donor, Louis DeJoy, to appear before a House hearing. They're coming back into session, which is, I guess, something, because they're taking some time away from their recess. But in general, the Democrats are not getting high marks for an aggressive response to the Trump regime's attack on the U.S. Constitution. What are your thoughts on that?
Yes, the Democrats have been extremely disappointing, but I want to emphasize that they're not a monolith. You know, there have been some that have been trying from the start to stop what they recognize as a kleptocratic, autocratic threat to our country from within. They saw this properly as a national security threat and public safety threat. These Democrats initially were stymied by the fact that they didn't have the Senate or the House. But then once they took the House, the ones who have actually wanted to do something productive, like impeach him on a large number of accounts, impeach him for the full scope of his crimes, use the Mueller report, or recently use things like inherent contempt that forced people to show up for subpoenas. And if they decide that they're not going to show up, they actually face penalties, fines, punishment, imprisonment. They wanted to use the power of the purse. They have all been stopped by Nancy Pelosi and others in the House leadership. And she has essentially been acting as Trump's accomplice and certainly as somebody who appeases him from the beginning. Back in March 2019, I'll never forget this, where she said she'll never impeach him no matter what he does because, quote, he's not worth it. And to me, that was basically her saying, the American people aren't worth it. His assault on the American people is not worth it. Our country isn't worth it. It's a baffling position. It's one that seems to be very unpopular among Democratic representatives themselves, because over the past week, I think in response to their own constituencies, they've become very vocal. They've been calling for Congress to return. They've been calling for hearings. They've been calling for more assertive action. But just like with impeachment, she had to be dragged kicking and screaming to serve her country. You know, her response was to tell Americans to give their mailman a flower. Like, I can't believe we're staring down the gun of fascism. And that is her response. But, it's criminal. And I'm just glad that there are some Democrats out there who really are trying hard and are trying to do the right thing and, you know, are fighting a very difficult fight, not just against a criminal Republican Party, but a complacent Democratic one, which, you know, in the end, yields the same result.
That was Sarah Kendzior, author of the book Hiding in Plain Sight, The Invention of Donald Trump and the Erosion of America, and co-host of Gaslit Nation, a weekly podcast. Find more analysis and commentary on the latest Trump attempt to cheat his way to victory in the 2020 election by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. When former Vice President and 2020 Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden selected California Senator Kamala Harris as his running mate, the pick was lauded as bold, sending a positive message of a party that embraces diversity and inclusion. If elected in November, Harris would be the nation's first female, first Black, and first Asian American vice president. Kamala Harris, whose parents were immigrants from India and Jamaica, was quickly attacked by President Trump, who declared her a radical, while also questioning her eligibility to run for vice president, despite the fact that she was born in Oakland, California, and is a U.S. citizen. Trump's racist birtherist smear campaign is an echo of the attack he earlier launched against Barack Obama. Senator Harris has faced questions on her current advocacy for criminal justice reform, stemming from her time as a prosecutor, district attorney, and California Attorney General, where she had a reputation for being tough on crime. Her record is filled with contradictions on issues such as the death penalty, prosecuting police violence targeting communities of color, and dismantling the prison industrial complex. Your reporter spoke with Kevin Alexander Gray, an author and activist who served as Jesse Jackson's South Carolina presidential campaign manager in 1988. Here he assesses Biden's pick of Kamala Harris as his vice presidential running mate and the critical need to mobilize progressive activist groups to push for social change both before and after the November election.
If you look at her history and Joe Biden's history, his history with the crime bill, his history with Anita Hill and the Supreme Court, with busing, she is certainly, as it relates to her politics, not as bad as the person at the top of the ticket who vouched for Obama. It's no question it's 2020, it's a whole new game, but if you look at her history and Biden's history, well, Biden has a worse race history than she does. So if she is progress for the Democratic Party from where Biden was, certainly that's progress. I don't know if I would just call that progressive, but certainly she is different. I think a lot of what has to happen in the future is the pressure that an organized movement, not a narrow movement, but an organized, broad-based movement can put on the Biden administration to have some kind of progressive change, in economics and housing and health care. But still, all of it takes organizing at the grassroots level. And it certainly doesn't need to come from the Democratic Party level because, you know, the art of politics is about compromise. The art of the outside game is to push them to where at least the compromise isn't as bad as it could be if it was just Democrats compromising with Republicans.
Kevin, I wanted to drill down a little bit on your, I think, very correct reading of the necessity of mobilizing progressive activist groups, not just before the election, which is essential, but after the election. There's a lot of criticism of progressive activist groups who did not mobilize to pressure President Obama when he took office in 2009, and a lot of the progressive priorities went by the wayside. Of course, we were confronting an economic crisis at that point. But here we are in 2020, and if Joe Biden and Kamala Harris win office and enter the White House in January of next year, what is your prescription for mobilizing progressive groups?
You mentioned Obama was a lesson to be learned, especially with so-called progressive groups, especially in the black community, where people basically stood down. You had black institutions from the NAACP, the Rainbow Coalition, black newspapers, black activists. Everybody stood down because they didn't want to see the first black president be embarrassed, and they were proud of just the achievement of Obama winning the White House. So there weren't a lot of demands placed on Obama. I mean, a lot of folk like me, or there are some folk like me that were very critical of Obama, and we caught it during those periods of time. I mean, we were vilified, or we were, you know, shut out from the community in many respects. And a lot of folk come back to you and say, man, you know, you were right. But, you know, Obama shows what we didn't do when we should have been mobilizing. I mean, Obama, it was about, well, doing what neoliberals do, try to appeal to people that would never be with him. I mean, you appeal to a racist is never going to be with you. And that led to where we are today with a lack of cohesive social movement organizations and institutional civil rights organizations. So obviously what we have to do is go back and organize on the local level. You have to do neighborhood organizing. You have to know the people in the neighborhood, know what they need, and you have to start putting pressure on the local level. There needs to be new organizations in the black community, and maybe Black Lives Matter will be a crucial organization in the black community, but it won't be crucial unless it does some intergenerational organizing, if it doesn't become arrogant and self-righteous and think that they can come into communities and tell communities what it is that they need without talking to the people in the communities and involving them. Their structures have to be democratic. Those are the kinds of things that we have to do, build local-based, democratically structured organizations that put pressure from the bottom up.
That was South Carolina-based author and activist Kevin Alexander Gray. He's co-editor of the book, Killing Trayvons, an Anthology of American Violence. For more analysis and commentary on Democratic vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris and the direction of the Democratic Party, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In early August, Hurricane Isaias roared through the Caribbean and up the eastern seaboard of the U.S., wreaking familiar destruction. The storm's high winds caused more than 3 million homes and businesses to lose power. Thousands were still without electricity a week after the storm, which brought down thousands of trees, utility wires, and poles. 1 week later, a derecho, or fast-moving violent windstorm, tore through the Midwest, leaving another 1 million utility customers without power. After two destructive storms within a few months of each other in 2011, then-Connecticut Governor Daniel Malloy appointed a panel to investigate the breakdown of the system that left some residents spending 2 weeks in the dark. The panel's main recommendation was to authorize the state's two investor-owned utilities permission to cut down trees surrounding their energy transmission infrastructure in order to harden the system. Almost a decade later, yet another storm has had the same destructive impact. Now, in addition to the trees that were felled by Isaias' fury, thousands more are likely to be cut down in another effort to harden the infrastructure. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Joel Gordis, a Connecticut-based energy and environmental security strategist who has long advocated energy microgrids and other methods not to harden infrastructure, but to make it more resilient.
Right now we have what is called a centralized grid, and that means that you have a bunch of fairly large generators that are placed in certain positions, and those supply your power. The problem with this is you're relying on transmission lines and distribution lines. Those are two different types of lines. If there's trees and stuff that are fragile, they can come down and disrupt, as we saw recently. The other option is to decentralize the grid, meaning you have a bunch of small generators that are much closer to the point of use, and you have them set up that if one goes out, maybe another can carry the load for it and such. It's a neater way of doing it rather than having all the large transmission lines and being dependent on just a very few plants. And the plants, of course, sometimes have problems themselves, or like the nuclear plants go down for refueling on a periodic basis. That's known. But, you know, during a storm like what we had, horrendous storms, this is what we have to put up with, these long-term outages. And the two storms in 2011, we had a very lengthy investigation of it that, well, it had a number of people on this board that they put together to investigate it. And that's all well and good. But the problem, the main problem as I look at it, is they just did the two storms. And what we need to be thinking about is an all-hazards approach. So let's say you can go ahead and do something that helps for the falling trees.
You mean undergrounding the wires?
I would say when you're putting in some of these new generation types of things, putting them underground where you can is an added bonus, and looking at ways of protecting your trees definitely should be part of the process. Now, whether you can do it successfully or not, I couldn't say right now. But, you know, right now there's this willy-nilly type of thing of cut down all the trees, and you're going to find this mindset after this, and you're going to see tremendous tree cutting, just as we have seen after the two storms in 2011. It still leaves it open to about five other different hazards.
What are some of the other hazards you think we need to guard against, Joel Gordis?
For instance, we're in the age where we are so totally dependent on cyber types of devices, you know, and it's a matter of that we need to start looking much more at the cyber threats that are out there from internal and external sources. And that can be a country, it can be a group that is disenchanted with us, anything. You know? And then the other thing is, too, having a military background, I always say, you know, the real good thing is during the middle of a storm and you're coming out of it, right, go ahead and do a cyber attack on it. So that's what's called a blended combination of threats that can take over. So you have not just the storms. And everybody, by the way, one of my real pet peeves is people talk about hardening the grid. We tried hardening after 2011 when we had similar outages. Where are we? You don't want hardening. Hardening connotes brittle. Brittle connotes fragile. Okay? What we want is a term called anti-fragile. There's a whole book written on it called Anti-Fragile by Nassim Taleb that's really good. And what we want is resilience. We do not want hardening. It's a bad word. It should be expunged from our energy vocabulary.
That was energy and environmental security strategist Joel Gordis. For more information on addressing the multiple threats to our current energy grid, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Verdant Square Radio in New Providence, New Jersey, KRBX in Boise, Idaho, KYRS in Spokane, Washington, and dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harrison.